Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, I'm Alan Cumming, and welcome to My Shelves. My shelves are sort of a museum of my life. I like to keep things from my travels that are, to me anyway, the very essence of the experiences I've had. Sort of portals, if you will, to a specific time and place. And the inspiration for stories and memories and musings. Here's my Obama wobbly head that I got at the Denver Democratic Convention when he spoke and said he would want to become the president. Here's my actual Etch-a-Sketch, my magic Etch-a-Sketch from my childhood. It still works. And today I'm talking to Caroline Thompson.
The interviewer was totally charmed by the movie Bless His Heart and waxed lyrical about its lyrical qualities, and then was mystified that someone as evil as yourself would have been the voice of Black Lady.
Hilarious.
Welcome, bienvenue. Welcome.
Caroline Thompson is a screenwriter, a director, a producer, a novelist. Her many screenplays include The Secret Garden, Homeward Bound, The Addams Family, The Nightmare Before Christmas, Corpse Bride, Edward Scissorhands. In fact, she adapted the screenplay of Edward Scissorhands into a stage piece with one of my other guests on Alan Cumming Shelves, Sir Matthew Bourne. I have been in two of Caroline's films, Buddy, with Rene Russo and a bunch of chimpanzees, but we first met when I appeared in her film Black Beauty back in 1994. Now, actually, technically, I didn't appear in Black Beauty, just my voice appeared because I actually voiced the eponymous horse. That's right. Since then, we have stayed firm friends, had many, many laughs together, and also we share a vocation. We like to liberate things from hotels. And in fact, the item that we're talking about today from my shelves is one such item. Caroline, this butter dish is a very great memento of a magical trip we took. And I believe you have a matching butter dish in your possession too.
Of course I do. It was the favorite holiday of all time. It was the best.
It was so great, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Do you remember the catchphrase, the catchphrase and the sort of justification for us both having
this butter dish? Would you like me to tell it to you?
Yes, please.
It's so small, it must have been meant as a gift. And that probably would have count if we'd been on the ground floor, we might have even taken the sofa and called it. It's
I remember we actually had a conversation with my brother. We went to that place in Leith, that sort of whiskey society place, and met my brother when he was living in Edinburgh. And almost seriously talked about the possibility of him driving a van up and sort of backing a van up to the so we could get a chair out. But it was, we were like too high up. I think this is hilarious. This shows kind of like just all the things I've stolen over the years. But it was such a great trip.
Yeah, we stole a lot on that trip, not just the butter dish.
I know. What else?
Do you remember calling down to the... Well, first of all, we had a giant suite and ordered room service in the sort of conference room of the suite so that we would get the tray and the and all the dishes. Yes. And so, and you, I think you bought, I think you even bought a new suitcase so you could take all that stuff home. And, but do you remember calling down to the front desk and asking if they had cello tape or scotch tape as we know it?
Yeah. So we could wrap up our stolen pervy.
Well, so you could keep the decanter top on firmly of the crystal whiskey decanter. So the whiskey wouldn't slosh out while it was en route. Of course, we had emptied our decanter, so we didn't. You did.
Oh, my God. It was so good. I think it's a really interesting thing, because that trip was sort of a surprise, wasn't it? I mean, the whole reason we went on this trip was because your assistant had found some traveler's checks or something like that, wasn't it, that you didn't remember?
Well, so the trip started because we were going to Glasgow to Elmer Bernstein's 75th birthday party celebration there, where the Glasgow yes. Symphony was playing a medley of scores.
The National Orchestra of Scotland was doing an evening of his things, yeah.
Indeed. And we had just done Buddy and he had just scored it. So he invited us to come join him. And I don't know if you remember sitting in the dining room of...
hearing this. We were sitting like having a quiet cup of tea, hearing the sounds of a party, a raucous party going on down below. And we saw people coming up and thought, oh, that's blah, blah. Oh, that's blah, blah. And then we realized that they were all downstairs having, and this is the greatest quote.
Okay.
I said, what's going on? He said, well, obviously they're having a party and obviously we've not been invited.
Which was really rude of them. I mean, the only reason we were there was because of Elmer.
And yes.
It was his agent, who I knew quite well, who was also there, who was throwing this party. It was, and I can remember... So when said agent passed by our table, we were like, oh, hello, hello. And then yes. I remember going to the room where they were having the party and opening the door and looking down the stairs into the banquet room and everybody waving and saying, hello, hello. And still we weren't invited to join them.
We had our own party.
Yes, we did indeed, which brings me to the next phase of that evening, which we went to the bar. Do you remember this?
Yes, yes, of course.
It was empty. You and I went behind the bar.
I don't remember this bit.
Oh, okay, all right, this is the best bit. I grabbed a bottle of, I don't know, I think it was Glenmorangie and stuffed it down my trousers. And you were perusing the vodkas and finally picked your vodka of choice and you were just stuffing it down your trousers when in walked the barman. And asked you what you were doing. You said something to the effect that was like, oh, I was just trying to see how it fit, or I don't know what.
Surely could talk my way out of this one.
Well, you didn't. You sheepishly put the bottle back on the bar.
God. I think it's okay to steal things from hotels like that, though. I mean, maybe not bottles of booze, but like... bowls and plates and things. I think in towels. I think it's fair enough.
Ashtrays,
I think they sort of expect it.
Yeah,
ashtrays.
Not sure about the crystal sort of decanters. Stuff.
The crystal decanter was maybe taking it a little too far, but
oh, are you ashamed now? No. This was
no. I'm not ashamed. I'm not ashamed. No.
This was the most.
I'm talking about it on a podcast.
I know, but you're seeming to wind it back, and
I'm just thinking it's maybe maybe I wouldn't do it again, but it was also something about this. It was like a thrilling challenge. It was sort of like we were on this. We were like Bonnie and Clyde.
Yes.
So on a sort of.
I remember at the what was the name of the hotel in Edinburgh? The Balmoral.
The Balmoral. Yeah.
So I remember.
Yeah, and you obviously you'd spent a whack of cash. Oh,
these assistant rooms. Had found like I don't know $5,000 worth of traveler's checks. I didn't realize I had spoiled.
I think it was 10. My favorite bit about staying there was we went into to have dinner, and the sommelier was called Johnny Walker, which was just fabulous, like a sommelier named after a brand of whiskey. And we had this delicious dinner, I remember. And at the end, we were having dessert wines, and we asked him to advise us on the, and he was this little short,
looked like a jockey almost. He was tiny.
Yes, he was. He was like a little jockey. Maybe, was he a ginger? I think he might have been a ginger.
I think he might have been
and
a ginger,
he,
yeah.
He was just a little sweetheart. And we asked him about the dessert wine menu. And he went, oh, that's a weird wee grape. And I said, I'm having it.
And it was from Oregon. Him. Do you remember? It was an American dessert.
Oregon, yes.
And he and we
Oregon.
And he told us the story of traveling America looking for wee wee grapes.
Totally fascinating.
And
totally
remember
fascinating.
They used to make him take the whiskey tours because of his name.
Yes. It must be the bane of your life to be called, like, if your name's Jack Daniels or something. Do you know what I mean? It must be awful.
And he could have called himself Jack Walker. I mean, he could have wiggled his way around.
Yeah.
It, so.
Yeah, he could have called John Walker. If he said John Walker, you wouldn't have thought, yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
So the reason for the trip was that you had made this film. You had written and directed this film, which I was in, called Buddy. And
we
shot that in Los Angeles.
A undervalued piece of work.
Totally. A lost gem, ladies and gentlemen. Please. Indeed. Is it available to stream in anywhere right now? Do you know?
I don't know, but I imagine on Prime you can find everything. So
I'm sure, yes.
Buddy.
Which was a Buddy, and it was about a gorilla named Buddy, and Renee Russo played this lady. It was set in the 1920s, and she lived in Long Island, and she had all these animals, wild animals, and I was her assistant, Dick, and I looked after her animals, and especially her chimps. I was the chimp man. So what was so fantastic for me was that I was when I was shooting the film before I did before that was Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion, and during my gaps on that, I would go out to this place in the desert and just basically let chimps crawl all over me and cuddle me, because I had to get used to these five chimps that I was going to have to work with in this film. It was such fun. I just loved it so much, and just spending all these days out there.
The wackadoo part of the story is that Rene Russo's character raised these chimps and this gorilla as if they were her own children.
Yes, yes.
Which, when Buddy the gorilla hits adolescence, has predictable consequences.
That's right, because she takes him to the World Fair in Chicago, isn't it? And he goes nuts. He goes nuts and marauds
his hormones
everywhere.
His
hormones kicked in, yeah. It's such a beautiful film. And he's, and actually, you know, what was amazing was it was the chimps were real chimps, but the gorillas were all animatronic gorillas with three different people of different sizes as Buddy grew older. And it was, that was just extraordinary. It was the Muppet people who made the animatronic thing. Absolutely incredible. So, you know, it doesn't end well, really. But how did you find that story?
They sent it to me from Sony. Or was it Columbia at the time? No, it was Sony at the time. They sent it to me after Black Beauty. I became Animal Girl, you see.
But you are Animal Girl,
exactly.
Aren't you?
But I became public. I came out as Animal Girl.
I guess we should say how we met. So I was the voice of Black Beauty. I am Beauty, or I was Beauty, I suppose.
Oh, you're still Beauty,
in the past,
darling.
And I wasn't fishing.
But forever.
I was.
Oh, you were fishing.
And so, if you don't know, listeners, Black Beauty was a book by Anna Sewell, and there's been various versions of it. You see, there's a new version of it now that Kate Winslet plays my part. She's a girl.
I know. Well, they made it about two girls who lost their mothers. I don't even want to talk about it. I haven't seen it.
Like a lesbian horse story.
I don't know. That would be That would be more interesting, probably.
Yes.
Yes. But there is our Black Beauty is another underappreciated gem of a film.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film. And Caroline wrote and directed that. And she'd shot it in 1993. And then she was cutting it in at Pinewood or something. Yeah, Pinewood. And I got a call and had to go on audition to be the voice of the horse. And I got the part. And so suddenly there I was. P.S. in my life at the time, having an absolutely traumatic, crazy time. Getting divorced and all sorts, and just bonkers. And that's when I met you. And I was shooting a film in Ireland. I went back to London in a gap, went into the studio and recorded for a couple of days this heartfelt rendition of this horse's life. Oats, oats.
Do you remember? Well, you probably don't know why I chose to cast you.
Why did you? Yeah, we always wondered, actually.
You were just about the most, well, you were far and away the most fun person I interviewed. And I was so exhausted by that time. I just wanted to have fun. And it was the beginning of your well-earned reputation as the most fun man person in Hollywood.
Is that right? It was because I was fun rather than
you were adorable.
My dulcet tones.
I didn't care if you could act or not. You were just adorable.
That's so great.
And we had so much fun. We had so many laughs, and it was what I needed so much.
You were a woman directing a big Hollywood film in Britain,
surrounded
away
by
from
thousands
home.
Of years of experience in the form of old white men.
Yes, yes.
Few of whom wanted to really be helpful.
But at least you had your horsey people around you.
I did. No, it was a wonderful experience at the end of the day. It was a very, very difficult one. Yeah, I was directing my first film with absolutely no experience whatsoever. It was bonkers, even to try.
How did you get a big studio picture if you never directed anything before?
Well, I was cunning.
What did you do, you little fox?
Okay, well, so Secret Garden had come out and had done very well.
Which you'd adapted.
And it had done very well. So one of the studio executives at Warner's asked me if I would do an adaptation of Black Beauty. And I said, only if I could direct it. And they cautiously and reluctantly said yes. Then Homeward Bound came out that following February.
And which you'd written too.
Which I had also written. And I had calculated, I had believed that was going to be a giant hit. And I had calculated to turn my draft of the script in literally the week after the opening weekend of Homeward Bound. Homeward Bound was a gigantic hit. I became like, you know how it goes. I became like hero du moment. So boom, off we went. Did Black Beauty.
That's so clever.
I know, I told you.
But you also, I mean, it wasn't like you were a newbie. You'd written Edward Scissorhands and
Indeed,
Nightmare Before Christmas and things like that. So you were, you weren't a new kid on the block.
I wasn't on set very often because either directors don't want writers around much or writers don't want to be around much when they see what's being done to their script. So right. I'd had both of those experiences and I will not go into details, but... So I was, I was pretty inexperienced. But I also, right. I mean, as you know, I have opinions, so.
Yes, I'll see. So then you head off to London, make this big thing, and you're there for like a year, you're away from home for a year, and you've taken on this mammoth thing. And then all of a sudden I appear at the end of it and we have fun.
Exactly.
Hilarious.
That was my plan.
And it worked.
And we had... probably the best preview Warner Brothers had all year. We made, it was high 90s. It was like they were, and so suddenly my cutting room went from one room to a suite.
And really?
I got feted and, blah, blah, blah. And then they released the film the same summer as Lion King, Forrest Gump, something else. And they plunked it down smack dab in the middle of that instead of placing it smartly in the autumn or in the great February Homeward Bound slot. Uh-huh. So it sort of curled up and died. And so suddenly I went from being like, queen of Hollywood to being like another pauper all over again.
But like, it wasn't that long after that that you got to make Buddy though. So it kind of been all bad.
Well, Buddy was set up before, the release of Black Beauty. Again, cunning.
Uh-huh. You see, very good.
Survival was something I was actually really good at until I just decided who wants to survive this.
Hilarious.
And here's what I also want to say about you, my darling, is that all this occurred before Cabaret, before you became like, the pansexual darling of New York City. Before I had to shove every twat aside who said, he's my friend, he's my friend, he's my friend, no, he's my friend. I'm like, no, you motherfuckers, he's my friend.
Yes, I was just little, you little just me.
A wee little. And so I did do an interview the other week about Black Beauty, weirdly, another podcast. And the interviewer was totally charmed by the movie, bless his heart, and waxed lyrical about its lyrical qualities. And then was mystified that someone as evil as yourself would have been the voice of Black Beauty.
Hilarious.
I had to explain that this was your pre-evil days.
Pre-evil.
And also, I introduced you to the Mickey Mouse floral display at the Disney Studios. Do you remember that?
Oh, my God. I do remember that.
Mm, yeah. Your first visit to America was on Black Beauty.
That's right. Oh, gosh, because I had a hilarious visit to my first visit to America, which I detail in my new memoir coming out.
Hooray!
It was the first thing I ever, like I was 30, I think, before I actually set foot in America. Maybe I was 29. And it was to do some looping or some extra lines and, you know, ADR, we call it, on Black Beauty. And it was this, so I was suddenly... You know, my first trip to America, I was going first class to LA to do these things. And nowadays, it's so hilarious. You know, I would just do that in a studio. There's no need for me to go all the way across the world to do it. And I mean, I could probably do it in this room I'm in now on my phone or something. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yes. That's what's so crazy about the way technology has changed.
Well, we cut Black Beauty on film.
Yes. See?
I mean, I'm so grateful to have had the experience of doing things the old way and the new way, just to feel what it felt like.
Me too. Mm. No, me too. I love that. I love that. I know, you know, did quite a lot of films on film before it all kind of changed, and just what that felt like. How it was much more of a test, and it was much more, you were very conscious of having to get it right, and you know, there's much more tension actually about your work.
When I wanted to enlarge one little section of Black Beauty. I was like, oh no, that shot's way too wide. I want a close up. And we had to send that little bit of film to the lab. I don't know how many thousands and thousands of dollars it cost to enlarge those frames. And now you do it at the press of a button digitally.
Yeah. I know. It's crazy. It's so crazy.
Hello and welcome to Out to Lunch with me, Jay Rayner, the podcast in which I take a particularly brilliant famous person to a top restaurant and grill them to a turn. In this latest season, you'll find me having delicious dinners with the likes of Patrick Keelty, David Hare, Nina Conti, Dame Eileen Atkins and Mary Beard, and the reliably outrageous Miriam Margolyes.
Richard E. Grant was on that.
He has an almost compulsion to smell whatever's around him. Has he never come and sniffed you?
Probably wisely, no.
All that and so much more. So do join me. Out to Lunch with Jay Rayner. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So I got on the plane and I was just so excited, and it was still in the midst of this, you know, traumatic torpor time in my life. Suddenly was just leaving my life, going on this like for like 4 or 5 days, got on the plane and traveled posh for the first time ever. and was just thinking, what is going on? I remember just it was in the days on Virgin Upper Class where they would give you like a manicure or like a hand massage or a back massage. You know, you could get all these things. And I was just, I was just drinking this delicious wine and having this meal and flying across the Atlantic. And all of a sudden, I saw the ice floes, and I said, "Oh, I didn't realize we were flying a little low." I don't know. Anyway, then they said, "Oh, we're making an emergency landing in Reykjavik. Someone on the plane has got to get off. They're not." Yeah. So I'm like, "What?" I mean, I just thought that. Oh, this is typical. My life is typical of my life. I'm like having this lovely new experience, and it's all going very well. And Hollywood is calling, and suddenly I'm, emergency landing in some fucking crazy country. And so we get off at Reykjavik Airport, and Ruby Wax, the American TV, chat show host and comedian, she was on the plane as well because she was going to America to interview Tammy Faye Baker for her show. But because it was for the BBC, she was back in economy. She was furious. And she's furious and envious of my first class thing. Anyway, I went on Reykjavik Airport. We sort of ran around with our film crew filming things and just sort of passing the time because I didn't know what else to do. And I remember we were in this souvenir shop and they actually had fossilized seagull poop on a plinth.
What?
That was a thing you could buy as a memento of Iceland. I think that's just the most hilarious thing ever.
Did you buy some? Anyway,
no, I didn't buy it. Dang. No. But so then we get back on the plane and they say to us, "Well, we can't go all the way to Los Angeles because the pilots have flown too long. It's too many hours. So what we're going to do is fly to Maine." I was like, "Where's Maine?" And we're going to spend the night there. And then I just think, all right. So I just got on the plane. More drinks, blah, blah, blah. Get off at Maine. I see that, and there's all these buses. There's like a swanky, lovely, luxurious bus for the people in first class. And it's sort of like, trucks to take the people in the car. It was very class conscious, our modes of transport. I get chatting to Ruby Wax's crew and things like that, blah, blah, blah. And I get on a bus. I get on the wrong bus and I go to the wrong hotel. Ruby miraculously ends up in my swanky hotel and thing. So I'm with them and I'm in this hotel and I think, oh, this doesn't seem right, but oh, well, whatever. But then I thought, oh, gosh, I didn't have a mobile phone. I didn't know.
No one did.
You just used to get on planes and just hope that someone would be there to pick you up. That's what you did. I didn't have any contact things. It was nighttime in London, so I couldn't call my agents. I didn't know what to do.
And was I freaking out on the other end? Probably. I don't recall this.
No, I don't think you were, because this is what happened. So I was sitting. I had dinner with the crew, and I remember I came back to the hotel, our sort of budget hotel, and I said to the man, "Did anyone call for me?" And he went, "No." Like it was scoffed at the idea that someone was going to call. And so then I was just lying in my bed thinking, this is a nightmare. And I remember panicking that, because I'm going to have to stay an extra night. And it was like, I was supposed to be in the studio the next day. And then the film, there was one day after that. And then it had to be, it was like the, what do you call it? It was locked. The film was going to be locked 2 days. And I thought, oh my God, the whole thing's ruined. I was just having a total panic attack. And the phone rang. And I went, hello. And they went, "Hi, Alan. I'm from Warner Brothers travel department. I believe you're having a little bit of trouble." I said, yes, I've had a terrible time. We crash landed, not crash landed, but emergency landed in Reykjavik. And they said, and the pilots, they're too tired. We can't go. So I'm getting on this plane tomorrow to LA. And they went, "Don't get on that plane." I was like, what?
What?
And they went, "There is a car outside waiting for you." And I pulled the curtain back. There was a limo outside waiting for me. It was like a James Bond film.
What?
And I was like, and they went, "Get in this car. And there's a flight to LA and leaves in 55 minutes. Get on that flight." And blah, blah, blah. So I got on this United flight. I said to the Ruby's crew guys, I was like, "I've got to go quick. Ruby can have my seat in first class for the next leg of the thing."
Did she ever say thank you?
Yes, because, oh gosh, wait till I get to the end of the story. Oh, this is a good story. So I get there that night. I don't actually spend the night in Maine. I get there late and go to my hotel, taken to my hotel. And then so the next day, it's as though nothing happened. You know what I mean? I just was up the next morning.
So from my perspective, nothing happened.
No, I don't think so.
But you came in wild-eyed. I do remember that.
It was pretty traumatic.
Yeah.
And then we did some work, and I just remember going into the gates of Warner Brother Studios, and there was a huge big poster for Black Beauty outside Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. It was really exciting. I felt like I was in a movie of my own life. Do you know what I mean? I'd never been to LA, but never been to America before, never been to LA. Here I was in Hollywood going through the gates of Warner Brothers, and I was actually working at Warner Brothers.
And the rest of your life has been like that. The rest
of your life
has been a movie of your life.
It is. I do feel like that. Yeah. Uh-huh. All these things happen, and I'm just like, this is like, I mean, the good thing is I still find it surreal.
Yes, and bonkers. Indeed.
And at the same time, I'm it's my life. You know what I mean? It's interesting. I think that's you know, one of the reasons is that because I hadn't ever been in America or in Hollywood until I was like 30. I had a whole life and a whole experience before that. So mm-hmm. anyway, so I was supposed to be interviewing you. So about a year later or something, I was on Ruby Wax's show. And it was a show where you had dinner. And it was me, Martin Sherman, who wrote Bent, which I went on to do in the West End, and Olympia Dukakis, who's sadly just no longer with us, and Ruby. And you sit and have dinner and you chat and blah, blah. And Ruby starts talking about this trip and about how she... Because when we got to Reykjavik, she'd had a Polaroid and was taking Polaroids of, like, you know, people sleeping and things like that, and doing all these terrible things. And she said to me when we got off, she goes, "You may be in first class, but I got a better view of the stiff." And she showed me a picture, a Polaroid she'd taken of this man attached to a gurney being taken off the aeroplane.
What?
She's terrible. Yes. and then we were talking about this story, and I said, "I wonder whatever happened to that man. I wonder if he was all right." She went, "Well, do you know what?" And she went back to London after interviewing Tammy Faye Baker, and she had dinner with her husband and her father-in-law. And her dad was talking about one of his friends was on a plane and he'd had some new medication and, you know, and he said, you know, "It's terrible, really. I had a glass of red wine, took my medication. Next thing I know, I wake up in a bloody hospital in Reykjavik." And he just... So the guy got taken off the plane. It was Ruby's father-in-law's best friend.
Oh, that is hilarious.
How long do horses live?
Well, Chester, my first horse, lived to be 40, which is
wow.
Nowadays not as extraordinary, but when he lived to be 40, it was quite extraordinary. Whitney, my quarter horse, is in her mid-20s now. They don't live that long, and she's very, very gray, and who knows. Ponies, like Evie and now Lily, they live to be 50. So it really depends on the breed and on the you know, way they're cared for, of course, but... Mostly.
Yeah. You used to have this amazing ranch in Ojai. Mm-hmm. Like when I first met you, you had this place in Burbank, and
in Mr. Edland. We kept horses in our gardens as if they were our swimming pool.
Oh, that's right, like at that the bottom of the garden.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I forgot about that. That's right.
To the big park, so there was hundreds of miles of riding trails in there. So.
And there's a sort of a little lane at the bottom of your garden where all the little stables went out mm-hmm. onto it, where you mm-hmm. took your... That's right. Mm-hmm. And then you were making, you were building this place in Ojai, and I came with you. I remember like being, I stayed in that house before it was redone.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember 40th birthday. Well.
what are you referring to?
I'm not telling. I think I had an inflatable alligator called.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. You did, and I did a sexual act on it when you weren't there.
When I wasn't there, and then Aggie was no more. So,
well, I broke it.
Yes,
I broke the sexual act. I mean, you didn't
break the sexual. You broke the inflatable alligator.
I didn't realize that. Oh, I forgot that part. Oh my god. Well.
We had so many adventures.
I know. But you had this magical ranch you made in the guest house, of which there was one room that had you made a sign up saying the Alan Cumming room. And I went there so many times. I actually wrote, I think of it, it was so fondly, I wrote my first book a lot of it there. I wrote a lot of the anniversary party with Jennifer. We did.
You came up with the idea for the anniversary party, I think, in that guest house.
I think we did.
Yeah, in that big hot tub.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Anyway, I wasn't there, but that's what you told me.
No, but me and Jennifer in the hot tub.
And Jane.
And Jane Addams, yes, that's right. We came. Oh, then we were there for an earthquake at your house, because it was like it was a great earthquake
in Ojai.
It was a yes, Caroline. This was such fun. I mean, it sounds awful, but I actually loved being in an earthquake.
Oh yeah, we had one yesterday here.
Did you really?
Mm.
A big one?
No, but enough to go like oh, and then for you're like oh that was an earthquake, and then the adrenaline starts. But
that happened.
Yeah.
But this is a huge one. You slept through it, I remember. It was quite late at night. And Jane and I may have been stoned. And so we were sitting on the sofa in the guest house. Yes. And all of a sudden this thing started banging. And I thought it was her dog's tail banging against wagging her tail, and it was hitting against the sofa. But then it wasn't. And then the sofa's moving. And then like the floor was like, it was like a wave. And the light big chandelier thing was spinning and spinning and spinning, and this crazy noise, and
what?
It was a really big one.
How could
really
I have slept
we were like,
that?
You just, I mean, I don't know, maybe it was different because you were up the hill in the other house or something, but, and then all the doors were, couldn't close all the doors the next day. Jennifer slept through it too, actually. But what I was going to say was that place was sort of like, there was earthquakes, there was mudslides, there was floods. It was really perilous living there, wasn't it?
Well, the oddest thing is that the day I moved out, there was never a key to my house. I mean, it was remote enough that we never locked the doors, never shut the windows, never did anything. I went there. I went back to get my last things, and the house was locked up tight. Locked, 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 locked. The guest house, which I had left locked up tight, was wide open and the air conditioning was blasting. It was like, it was as if the place was saying, you know, okay, fine, screw you, you're leaving. I mean, it was really...
So many
people felt spirits there. I mean, there were people who wouldn't sleep in that guest house, especially in the mother's room, because they sensed spirits there. I mean, a week after I left, a saddle appeared on a saddle rack on the guest house patio. Porch, the front porch.
Wow.
Out of like, I don't know. I mean, it was a magical and haunted, but benign to me until that last day.
Because I thought you meant like the new people who bought it had locked the doors and you couldn't get.
No.
The house had sort of locked itself.
The caretaker said, "Walk away. I'm going to break in. I used to break into houses in Mexico City. I know how to do this."
Good to know.
So the next thing you know, he's got the front door open. But no, the place just was like, it was really vivid and very clear. But the most animal magical thing I ever saw there were two male bobcats during rutting season down by the horse arena, shrieking at each other like, "Ah!" Literally face to face, shrieking each other. I walked straight up to them and said, "Get out of here," and clapped my hands. Totally ignored me. It was as if I were invisible. They stayed there shrieking and shrieking and shrieking at each other, doing their, you know, their man, this is my territory thing. And I just went like, "Oh, well, whatever," and just walked away.
Oh, my God. And you had mountain lions as well, didn't you?
We did, but there was a mountain lion in the horse corral next to my old horse, just standing there, and they seemed to be good friends. But I thought to myself, I don't like this. So that's when we got our big dog, Reno, who was husky Labrador wolf. And Reno marked about, I don't know how many acres. It's hard to judge when you're standing in the middle of it, but I would say, you know, like a 3-acre, 5-acre perimeter around the main part of the ranch. And
that was like his land, and no one should cross it.
And they didn't. No animal. No, we used to have bears raiding the barn. We used to have the mountain lion. We used to have bobcats. We used to have deer, you know, all sorts. But after he marked his territory, nobody came through it until he got older. And when he got older, they started to come back through it.
They could sense it.
Fascinating. It was really fascinating. So then we moved and bought him a new house.
And what about all the sort of natural disasters? It seemed like from, you know, being your friend, and what you just seemed that every year there seemed was droughts, it was like pestilence and locusts.
Well, I remember
almost.
Coming. I had to come and get you and Grant down. The driveway was a mile long to the main road, and so I remember I had to come down. We had just had a big mudslide or rainstorm or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that ranch was in a valley of its own, at the bottom of the mountains, and so it was estimated that 1 million acres of rainwater dumped onto our place.
Ooh.
So wow. When that happened. The last big one was 2005, I think. And, I mean, literally it was just like a river and all the infrastructure just went to shit. But you know, what's odd, and you may have this experience from your own place, in the country. Those are the most vivid times, you know, you think like, oh my God, another disaster. And actually those are the times when you feel most alive in the oddest kind of way. So we were trapped in there. One of the disasters, we did get a mudslide that blocked our entrance and exit to the place. It was the length of a football field, 6 feet high, covered the road, and we were out of whiskey. And so our friend,
oh my God,
I know, fuck me. So our friend Crystal, who you may remember, who rode down the street, she's cross country on her horse with a giant bottle of Bushmills and heaved it across the churning river to land softly in the mud and be the hero of our experience.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Priorities. Billing.
Exactly. Well, we had food. It was just, we didn't have the great necessities. Yeah.
Oh, another sort of disastrous thing to happen around that property was that one time I was coming to visit, it was actually my birthday.
Oh God!
And it was in January. Obviously, it was when my birthday is. And in people might not know this, in California, it rains a lot in January. And then one of the things that happens is that one of the things that happened was that all the oil and things that were sort of on the road that was just kind of caked in with the heat, the water would sort of all churn up, and so it became incredibly slidey, not just sort of watery slidey, but sort of oily watery slidey. It's a phenomenon peculiar to Southern California, I think. Anyway, so I was driving up, and at that place called Santa Paula. Mm-hmm. I was just like la la driving up to car, and I said in the night, lots of rain, and the person in front of me, you know, braked late, and I pushed my brakes, and I just slid into the back of them, and I just thought, oh, you think, oh gosh, I'm going to rear end this person. Well, it kind of was more dramatic than I thought. Because I crashed into them and the airbags came out, and it was a huge deal. And what was hilarious, there was wine on the, I had bottles of wine I was taking up for you was in the back seat. So, and I just, you know, when an accident happens, there's that moment you think, oh, this is happening. And then it happens and you're like, what happened? And I remember the airbags went off.
You had whiplash too, I recall.
I did, and big, huge bruise across where the seatbelt was across my chest. But the airbag comes out and it's sort of gunpowder, the air. And so I thought there was fireworks. And there was booze, the smell of booze, because all the wine bottles smashed. And then there was the smell of fireworks. And I was like, ooh, a party. I remember thinking that. And I'd been in a car crash. And then everything all happened so quickly, like the firemen came, the police came, the ambulance came, and they kept saying, are you okay? And I said, yes. And I said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to see my friend Caroline. So they called you and you came to get me. And it was all, you know, I was embarrassed, and they said, they gave me a little card where to the garage where they were taking the car. They'd pulled the car away. It was kind of a write-off almost. And they did all the things and little marks on the road. And I remember I was just sitting I said, no, I'm fine. And I was sitting on a little wall by the road, just looking at these little marks on the road where this thing had happened. It started to rain. So I'm sitting in the rain, and this kid just drives up on his bike and goes, are you the guy who was in the crash? And I'm like, yes. And just, and he's like, oh, and just biked off again. And then you arrived. I was really, I think I was in shock.
You were. Mm-hmm.
Was I?
You were. But also, mind you, these are the days when you routinely scraped up cars because you had just started driving in America. I mean, this was prior to Buddy. And on Buddy, I don't know how many cars Steve had to get you, but a few.
I did have a couple of scrapes.
Mm.
I remember when you came up to you know what it was?
When you came up to my 40th birthday party, it was like on the offside. And trust me, I know this because whenever I drive in Ireland, the offside is always scraped up by the hedgerow. So on the offside of the American car, it's like it looked like Godzilla. It's great. The length of it.
I remember that we lived in that little apartment building, and getting out of the garage was a challenge every morning. You know, the underground. I remember I had a few times of that. But you came and got me, and it was actually the best thing I think possible to happen, because you just took me to this restaurant.
I know,
for a dinner.
Poor wee man. You just, and I know it was horrible. I to this day regret doing that to you, because you just sat there in total, your eyes were dilated and shock, and you were just like stunned. And I thought, oh my God, what have I done?
But what else would you do? Like put me to bed? But I actually think it was quite a good thing, because it just immediately, like I've had another car crash, and actually I fairly recently, we were supposed to have people coming over that night for dinner, and Grant, you know, when I got home, Grant said it was again just I just slid. There was no other cars involved, and it was in the snow this time, and crashed. And I think it'll be good. I just want to not have to. I think having something else to think about after something like that was good.
Fair enough.
But do you know that was like that? So don't feel bad about it.
All right.
But that car that I smashed up, I'd also ticked the wrong box.
Oh,
I'm a bit of a ditz when you put all these stories are just me being a total ditz when I think about it. I ticked the wrong box at the insurance or something, and I had to pay for the entire car.
I remember
and it was one of these things, and it went on for ages with the insurance company and everything like this. And I remember one time it was at I had lawyers. Why did I have lawyers? Was it the rent? I can't remember. Or was I being sued by the? I was being sued by the people a year to the day, minus one day after the crash. The people who I'd crashed into sued me for, hurting their neck or something. So it was all the rental lawyers and everything. And I was making a film in Prague, and I was about to go to New York and work there and everything. And it finally was resolved after this long, long time. And my lawyers, the rental company lawyers, we got so close and we'd talk so often. They used to send me clippings of myself. They used to mail me clippings from American newspapers and magazines. And when it finally
so
finished,
weird.
And it's so crazy. And when it finally finished and it was all resolved and it was all done, they said, you know, Alan, it's such a shame this is coming to an end. We're going to miss you. I was like, I'm not going to miss you. This has been a horrible experience of this car crash.
Well, I told you were the most fun person, maybe not just in Hollywood, but in the world. Everybody
the rental
wants
car
a piece
business.
Of you, darling. And thank you for inviting me to have a piece of you today.
I want to say I want to apologise for having had sex on your inflatable alligator and breaking it.
Oh, it's way too late for that, darling.
And also, you know, the other thing I want to thank you for was many things, for being in these lovely films and being my friend, but also I'd never seen a mariachi band before until your 40th birthday.
It was just special.
So great.
Yeah,
it really was. What are you doing now, Caroline? What are you up to?
So as I said, I paint. I've been painting. Well, so I have two preferred subjects: dead people and dogs in bed.
Oh.
So and then now I've just sort of. I mean, here's what I meant about getting nicer is now I've just started to doing portraits of friends' dogs, not necessarily in bed, because it puts a big smile on their face, and. You know, usually my job in life is to shock people and upset them, but I've discovered the joy of making them happy. So I've been doing That's these nice. Lovely little portraits of, so you should send me a picture of Lala and I'll do you a portrait, or of Honey.
Oh, I'd love that.
Yeah, they're actually quite good. I'll say, you know, it's it. It
I'd painting, love to see them.
Painting is something I always wanted to do. I had a traumatic experience as a 5-year-old where I painted a penguin at kindergarten, and the teacher was in awe, you know, grabbed it and ran down the hallway to the principal and said, look at this. And everybody came, and all the grown-ups came and were like staring at me like I was some kind of magic wonder child. And I took my penguin painting home to my mother, and she looked at it and she said, oh, that's nice, dear. And she crumpled it up and threw it in the trash.
What?
Yeah. Not a sentimental person there. She was just overwhelmed. You know, I mean, I'm not, but at any rate, it squashed my confidence as a visual artist. But it's something I've always wanted to do in the back of my mind. So I do it now. And I'm actually quite good at it, to be, if I may say so.
I bet. Have you painted a penguin?
No, I don't think I can.
It's too soon.
It's too traumatic. But
dead people and people, dogs. What about dead dogs?
I have a dead dog ready to paint. I haven't done it yet. So the dead people are, generally speaking, either accident victims or police photos from the 1920s.
Shut up. Oh my God, Caroline. So hilarious.
They're so, I mean, they are, I'll have to send you pictures. So anyway, so they're,
where do you get these pictures of
accidents? I would just look around for them. And there is I haven't painted one of Ouija's crime photos, but there was a famous crime photographer in the 20s in New York called Ouija. And so I've been nosing around doing him. And plus Steve had a friend who was a crime photographer in New York City during, I don't know, the 70s or the 80s. So I have a whole stack of his stuff to paint if I want.
So you've got a lot of source material.
Yes. I mean, I like it when it's, so the reason I like painting dead people is I love the feeling of gravity, and it's not the gore, but it's sort of the heaviness of the body on the earth.
Oh, I see.
I'm not quite sure why I love that so much, but to capture that sort of feeling of letting go, I think, there's something just that draws me to it, especially if it's, you know, wearing bloomers.
I'm funny.
But I don't, I don't like to paint, like, you know, the gore. That's not what it's about. It's about the bodies and the, I don't know. It's shocking, but beautiful is what
interesting because it's sort of like, well, that's, you know, I always think of you as a lot of your work is like that. It's like, it's like, you know, The Nightmare Before Christmas or something, you know, that those stories that are really like old grim fairy tales. They're lovely and they've got the things, but they're also really scary and dark. And but then
that's me. I mean,
that's you.
People ask, like, why would you do Black Beauty? Well, Black Beauty is a deep and sad and scary story.
Yeah. Ginger dies, people. Spoiler alert. It's traumatic.
And Beauty goes through so much difficulty in his
fire. Life. It's right. Awful, abused. Yeah. But also, like, you know, I remember in your house, and when you moved from the ranch, you sent us that amazing doll that you said to us, would you like something from the house? And I asked for this picture, which I've got in Scotland. It's beautiful.
The elephant?
The dog. It's like an elephant.
Yeah. It's a William Wegman.
William Wegman, And then Grant said about this doll, which is a little girl, sort of Mexican girl doll. But when you lift up her dress, she's got a little penis.
Well, here's what one of my favorite things you've ever said in my life, which is when Grant came to visit the first time, you said, don't admire anything. She'll give it to you.
I was right.
And indeed, he admired that little Mexican. I think it's, you know, women, it's a Victorian.
Oh, yeah, that was long before you moved, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, and it was a Victorian,
we had that for a while, yeah.
You know, it was a Victorian thing to dress boys in dresses. So I don't think that the illusion was that it was a girl. It was just a
I see.
It was a toddler.
who's been sort of dressed as a girl.
Dressed in dresses. I don't, and my friends now,
right, yeah,
with their little boys, they have these like sort of long Prince Valiant hair. There's some other new thing going on with androgyny, I guess it is. So, and you know, androgyny is my middle name. So there I go.
Yeah. So it makes sense then, the sort of death and animals. Darkness, yeah, and animals, and now that's your new, yeah, your new sort of career as a painter.
Yes, and
I can't wait. I can't wait to see you and have more fun and to go on another trip and
indeed
maybe procure some new items for us to laugh at over the year. So thank you so much for taking a trip down memory lane with me today, Caroline.
My pleasure, my darling. I love you.
I love you too. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Well, thank you for joining me, ladies and gentlemen, and those who don't define us either. I'll see you next time for another Alan Cumming Shelves. Alan Cumming Shelves is hosted by me, Alan Cumming, and produced by the lovely Jack Claremont. We are part of the Acast Creator Network and the Crowd Network too. We just love networks. Another Crowd Network podcast to check out is Unaccountable. It's a podcast fighting for police accountability in the United States. It's a podcast that tells the stories of innocent people who've been killed by the police, just like George Floyd, but also people like Mohamed Muhaimin, Shacey House, and Carrie Illich. And so many more you haven't heard about, but you really should have. The stories can be difficult to listen to, but this could be the most important podcast you'll ever hear. It's a podcast fighting for change, and we need to join that fight. Just search for Unaccountable in your podcast app now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.